Welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast. Gravity Leadership is a community of people seeking to live our lives in the orienting center of God's love in the midst of our post-Christian world, learning to lead like Jesus, live on mission, and make disciples. In nature, gravity is the phenomenon that brings stuff together, objects as small as atoms and quarks, and as large as stars and galaxies. We believe the gravity of the Christian life is the love of God revealed in Jesus Christ. The Gravity Leadership Podcast is curated conversations on what it looks like to practically orient our lives and our leadership in the love of Christ, the gravity that holds everything together.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Gravity Leadership. Maybe this is your first podcast for
us. You never know.
Welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast. And perhaps some of you are back and some of you will never be back, but this is your first time. And we just want to say welcome. It's good to be with you today in your ear holes. And we are excited to continue. Does this end? Is this ending our series on power?
It's one of the last ones. Probably.
We're down to
this is one of the last.
It's actually never ending.
It probably is a never ending series.
Well,
a little bit.
When you name your organization Gravity Leadership, we're always going to be talking about power. And we've been unpacking for the last several months how important it is that we talk about power and own and reckon with the fact that we have not fully assimilated and appropriated the power that's in the cross through Jesus and the havoc that's created socially and also spiritually in our churches. And today we have our good friend Rich Velotis joining us from New York City. Hey, Rich.
What's going on, fellas? Great to be here.
Yeah, it is. It is good to be here. Rich, would you, other than living in the Big Apple, would you give us an introduction, who you are and what you spend your time doing?
Yeah, and it makes it's important to say I'm from Brooklyn. The Big Apple is a big place. Born and raised in Brooklyn, live in Queens, pastor in Queens, and I have the great privilege of pastoring New Life Fellowship Church, a 31-year-old church that I've been at for 11 years and been the lead pastor at since 2013. And so, our church's claim to fame is down the block from our building is where McDowell's was from Coming to America. So Eddie Murphy, Arsenio Hall.
Oh, nice.
And one of the scenes of Coming to America, they're cleaning outside. Our church is in the background. In addition to that, I'd say a beautiful mind, Russell Crowe's movie, A Beautiful Mind. There's a bar scene, and that bar scene was filmed in our church in the lower level.
Oh, really?
It's the longest bar in Queens. Our middle schoolers meet there. So there you have it.
Nice.
Your middle schoolers meet at the longest bar in Queens.
That's right.
Cheers.
In your church basement. That's great. That's awesome, Rich.
Great. Great, Rich. New Life Fellowship is a church that maybe came of some renown because the founding pastor, Pete Scazzaro, wrote a book, several books around being emotionally healthy. Right? Emotionally healthy church, emotionally healthy spirituality. Was that one of the reasons you came there? Was that a draw for you?
Yeah. You know, when I came across emotionally healthy spirituality in 2006, I was drawn personally to the contemplative tradition from the age of about 20, 21. And so I'm 40 years old. So for the past 20 years, I've been deeply immersed in this. But I didn't know that there were churches that were actually practicing this stuff. And so when I read the book, I said, man, this is great. And then I said, oh, this church is doing this, and in Queens. And so I got connected with the ministry. But yeah, I mean, I came to New Life because I was drawn to the contemplative tradition as well as this tradition of interiority out of emotional health.
Yeah.
So that's why I came.
Yeah. And that book was a huge... That book, Emotionally Healthy Church, Emotionally Healthy Spirituality, put language to a lot of deep intuitions and longings I had about not only what was wrong with me, but what was wrong with the churches and systems I had been caught up in.
Yeah.
And part of me feels like Gravity Leadership would have been called Emotionally Healthy Leadership had Pete Scazzaro...
Not taking the name. No, there's tons of resonance. There really is tons of resonance between what we do and kind of what is espoused in there.
So if you haven't read that those resources from Pete. Highly recommend them. Mm-hmm. But today, Rich, we've been doing a lot of critiquing and deconstructing of what's wrong with power in the world and how that those assumptions and those embodiments, we kind of transport or transfer those things into the church. We kind of run the world's playbook on power and hope to get results in the church. And we do get results. They just, as we've been talking about, they just oftentimes are worldly results because we're using worldly means. And we thought it'd be great to have you on the podcast to chat a little bit about what in the world is different about heavenly power, mm-hmm. kingdom power, Jesus power, as it relates to or contrasted from worldly power. So where would you like to start?
Well, I've been thinking a lot about this, and there's a passage of scripture that I've been basing a lot of talks on, framing it around whether we're talking about race, whether we're talking about character formation, and it's this passage out of Matthew 20. And I've been in it. I mean, I probably the last 15 months, I've been in it, in and out of it. Ooh. And it's a passage where the mother of James and John, mother, come to Jesus, and they're asking for power, for authority, really, for a seat at the table, but not just a seat at the table, like the seats to the left and right of Jesus. And she's asking for this seat, and Jesus, first of all, tells her, you don't know what you're asking for. And you don't know what this means, the implications of this. And then he asks another provocative question, can you drink the cup I'm going to drink? And they respond, yeah, absolutely. And
no problem.
And
if you're buying.
Yeah, we got it. We got it. I'll take two cups. And then Jesus painfully says, listen, by the way, this is not my job to determine who gets to sit here, and you're going to drink the cup. What is this?
Right, right.
And so, but when I look at that, I think about the nature of power, that we often don't know what it entails and the cost of it and what it means to do power in a kingdom kind of a way. And then Jesus goes on to talk about, we do things differently in the kingdom where we don't lord it over. We're servants. We're here to wash feet. We're here to do things differently. And so when I think about power, that's a text that I've been drawing a lot of now, implications of leadership, implications of marriage, implications of race. But that's kind of like a foundational text for me in the recent year and a half.
Yeah. So in that, then there's this sense in which you're sort of finding like our longing for power in this question that James and John through their mother bring to Jesus, right? Like, hey, let us sit on the right and the left. We're confident that we would do some good things with that power. Like we can handle it. We can drink the cup. And I like that you brought up that passage, because it seems like Jesus is pointing to the cross, right? To say like there, you know, you want to be on my right and my left. Like I'm going to be enthroned in a way that you're probably not expecting. And so the cross kind of informs the way that power works in the kingdom.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I mean, we talk about, and some of the talks that I've given talk about a cruciformity as the means and the way of power. It's not that power is a bad thing. Power is a good thing. But the way we wield it and come under it and is we are to be very different from the world, and it's a cruciform power.
Yeah. So cruciform is a word that we like.
Yeah.
And I hear from people like, I don't know what that means.
Yeah.
So could you unpack that? What are some attributes or characteristics of cruciform power, and how is that distinct from other power?
Well, I think for the sake of just simplicity, cruciform power looks like Jesus on the cross. And it's vulnerable. It doesn't make sense to the world. It's counterculture. It's counterinstinctual. And so while Jesus is being crucified in a very powerless position, this is the power of God for the salvation of the world. And so cruciformity is Jesus on the cross. And it's that in all of its simplicity, vulnerability, and perceived weakness. And so when I talk about power, I have to begin by saying, what does it look like to model this kind of vulnerability, perceived weakness, for the sake of a larger transformation that God is trying to do in me and through the community that I'm a part of. So in short, it looks like Jesus on a cross. So, and it's very painful. But I think it's ultimately what the world is longing for, and the path towards redemption in our local and global spaces.
All right. So I hear humility. I hear
vulnerability.
I hear weakness. Yeah. So, let's can we bring this down to like ground level for you, Rich? Like, what, how does that work its way out in dealing with a large church in Queens where people act like people and you have, you know, conflict and you have, you know what I mean?
Leadership, like, responsibility, you've got accountability and stewardship of an institution. Like, how does cruciformity work itself out in those environments, right?
Any on the ground tactical practices that guide that for you?
No, absolutely. And just to give you, I think it's helpful to give context, because our church, it's a very large church in Queens. We probably have on a given Sunday, 1,400 to 1,500 people, which means it's part of our community. It's probably, people don't come to church every Sunday anymore. So it's probably 1,800 to 2,000 people are part of our church.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Beyond that, we have 75 nations represented.
Wow.
Very diverse socioeconomically, very diverse generationally, culturally, I mean, theologically, politically. I'd say 30% of our church voted for Hillary Clinton in the 2016 election, 30% for Donald Trump, 20% probably abstained, another 20% wrote in Batman or Spider-Man as their candidate. And so it's very, there are lots of tensions, especially in the post-2016 world in the church that I lead. And so how do I now demonstrate power in this kind of a way? So, but very practically, I think what makes cruciform power different from the world is it starts with me and how I choose to lead myself. And I think cruciformity, the painful, it's easy to tell people what to do and to give instructions and such. But I think cruciform power is about, am I doing the hard work of first curious, compassionate, but honest self-examination? And it is out of that place where I'm trying to remain close to myself, so also remaining close to others, especially in times of high anxiety, which is a good definition of differentiation. But how can I remain close to myself if I don't know myself, if I'm not practicing a curious, compassionate, honest self-examination? And so for me, power is like, I mean, am I honest with myself of how I am using power? Where am I feeling entitled? Where is this sense of you owe me? I'm the pastor here. You need to listen to me. And I mean, that stuff creeps in me on a regular basis. I mentioned in some talks that when I became the lead pastor at New Life, the first thing that I lost, and not even just a lead pastor, I became a pastor at New Life. The first thing I lost was parking lot privileges. And in Queens, we don't have a lot of parking spaces in Queens.
Yeah.
So folks have to often circle around the block to find a parking spot. And the first thing I lost was, they said, great, you're on our staff now. Congratulations. By the way, you can't park in the parking lot anymore. And I thought, wow, this is terrible. And so to this day, I don't park. I'm the lead pastor of the church. There's no parking spot that says like lead pastor on it.
Yeah.
Like I have to get there 30 minutes before the service starts, 40 minutes, find the parking spot and walk. And there are days where I'm like, this is terrible. and many days like that. And then I realized, do I feel entitled here?
Yeah.
But I think it's a great demonstration of power here. We're going to lead a different way. And I never forget watching to this day, Pete Scazzaro, he's been doing this for many years. I see him walking as I'm coming into church, like three blocks down. And here this guy is world-renowned author, pastor, and here he is just walking three, four blocks down. He could have easily said, I need the parking spot. I need to preach. I need to get here on time. But we decided to do it differently. And so I think it starts with self-examination. And very practically, I think like it's a life of real listening. it's a life of listening. And I'll give you something anecdotal and then maybe we can continue to riff on this. But we had a gospel and race conference a few months ago. And we invited some really some world-class practitioners and theologians to come and talk about gospel race, how is this working out. And our church, as I mentioned, is very diverse. I think we've been making great progress over 31 years. And about 2 weeks after the Gospel and Race Conference, there was a group of African Americans in our community who sent me an email saying, Rich, can we meet with you? Because we feel, and they weren't speaking for everyone in the congregation, but they say, we feel like we're invisible and our voices are not heard. And I'm thinking, here we are, we're a very diverse church, we're doing great things. And I could have said to myself, you know what? Everyone at some point is not going to feel listened to, and especially right. in a diverse church like ours. Yeah. But we took, me and our executive team took a 2-hour conversation to listen, and it was very painful to hear folks in our congregation say, we feel invisible. We don't feel like our stories are being told. And in that moment, I had a legal pad, and I say this not to say like, hey, I'm doing such a great job. It was very painful actually to listen there, and I wanted to say a lot. but we had a 2-hour session where I just listened and then scheduled another one to have some follow-up dialogue at that moment. But I think it's creating space to listen as a leader in this space here. So, but that's cruciform. It's I'm not fixing, I'm not solving, I'm not self-justifying, I'm listening. Yeah. So those are two kind of things that come to mind initially.
Yeah. And what I hear about your listening isn't, this is the way to pacify and placate. This is a tactic to use to help disturbed people feel heard. Yeah. And I do this thing, this technique to them, and then I go on with my life. But rather, you're actually listening. As though you have something to learn.
Yeah.
100%. I mean, we teach a skill at New Life called incarnational listening, in which we invite people to leave their world. This is a pattern after Jesus, obviously, leaving his world, entering into a new world, and allowing his life to be shaped by this new world while he holds on to himself. And so it's, you know, as he's God, he's fully God, fully man. So he's holding on to himself in one way and entering into the space of others. And so in that space where I'm trying to leave my world, enter into their space, and I don't fully always understand why holding on to myself. And I took maybe 2-3 pages of notes as I just listened and just sat with it. It was very painful, actually.
Yeah, did you agree with it? I mean, were you fighting, like, justifying, defending, rationalizing as you sat there? Or were you able to listen to them with a non-anxious, condemning presence? Like, how'd that work for you internally?
I'd say 70% of the time I was non-anxious listening. 30% of the time I'm going, now wait a second.
Hold on.
I walk three blocks to the church every day.
Come on.
Like, are you serious? Really? Yeah. But I knew going in that my task was not to defend myself. My task was not to have kind of like in the Dallas Willard sort of way, the last word. I was like, I'm not here to have the last word. I'm here to let you have the last word. And I recognize the level of power I have, and I could have easily have the last word here. But my goal was not to, it was to listen. It was to learn. And I found that even in the simple practice of that exercise of just listening, it solved probably 80% of the problems. They still wanted some certain thing, had some requests about certain things that they wanted to get done, which I didn't say, yes, we're going to do them. I said, we're going to go back and I'll talk to some of our pastors and elders and we'll discern together. But I think 80% of the tensions was relieved because I just sat there with my pen and legal pad. I brought out the legal pad. I didn't bring out like my cell phone notes there. I brought out a literal legal pad.
Yeah.
So yellow too. Pretty nice.
So what's important is, I think there's so many people, Rich, that we interface with. And Hartman, I want to hear from you on this too, because we've had conversations offline about this. So many people that have these convictions, they're convicted to lead in humility. They're convicted to lead in cruciform love. But then when push comes to shove, when four people show up with the 95 theses and they want to nail them to your parking sign, you know what I mean? Like your pastoral parking sign. Like what happens is you know, the gates of hell break loose within us. And we don't have the formational readiness to live our convictions. But a couple things I heard, I want to maybe name them, and maybe you can say them better than this, or if you have things to add. But one is, to lead in cruciformity means that you actually live as though you have nothing to lose except for what you'd want to lose anyway.
Yeah.
You're not guarding or protecting or defending anything. It's like, if the worst thing that could happen here is that they give me one or two or three or 30 ways that I need to repent, which is actually the best thing that could happen to me today.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And that's a different way of embodying power, right?
Yeah.
I think this is why, in many respects, Jesus says, blessed are the poor in spirit. And I think when Jesus talks about the poor in spirit, I think about the poor have nothing to prove, nothing to protect, nothing to possess. And Jesus says the kingdom belongs to these kind of people, free enough to receive like the abundance of God's life. And I think if I'm living in this kind of way, I believe I have nothing to prove, nothing to protect, nothing to possess.
Yes.
And Matt, I think you're nailing it there. If I can live in this kind of, this is freedom. This is, I don't have a false self to protect. I have lots to learn. I have nothing to prove. Now, it's easier said than done.
Yeah.
But I think this truly is the way of freedom. And I've had my own, I've been at this church 11 years, 7 years as the lead pastor. And it hasn't always been like this, but I think in recent years, recent months, really, I've experienced a level of freedom, interior freedom, from the need to be triggered every time someone has something negative to say, which is a lot of times.
Yeah. Mm. Wow. Yeah. I'm reflecting on that. I think there's like in my own life, I have this, like the feeling of letting go of some of those things is like fear comes up. I think we really have to trust that as we embrace this, you know, this way of being, as we embrace, you know, having nothing to prove, nothing to possess, nothing to protect, like as we embrace that, we really have to trust that God is actually present and that God is actually working. Because I think the anxiety that oftentimes keeps us from living in that freedom is the fear that, like, nothing good is going to happen through my leadership.
Unless I hold on to this, unless
I can prove this, unless I, you know. And so there's this fear of, like, if I let go of this stuff, like, is anything good going to happen? Like, is God actually with me? Is God going to do anything? Is God really active here in ways that I, like, if I don't control it, will anything good happen?
But that's the irony, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's the irony, is that the only way that God does... We actually don't get God to show up. We actually just decrease our resistance to the God who's showing up. And so one of the ways we do that is we, you know, our flesh says to us, justify yourself. You know, create all the benefits of salvation that you need from your control, right? Yeah. Protection and possessions and approval and things like that, right? But then if we actually, like Rich is talking about, if we dare to trust that we don't, that we already have that, we don't need it. Yeah. In this conversation, nothing is threatened here. Then we actually create space for those things to happen.
Yeah. We discover what God might do, and it might be surprising.
Yeah. Which is why I think when we gather on Sundays for worship and preaching and communion and all that, we are confessing we are a resurrected people. And following a resurrected Lord. And the resurrection for me is not just, hey, we get new bodies when Jesus makes all things new. Vindication. He's vindicating Jesus for the self-emptying way of the cross. And so we trust in this resurrection that when we choose this way of cruciformity, this is the kind of life that God ultimately vindicates. And it might not happen in the time we want. It might not happen in the moment, but we are a hopeful people believing that vindication will indeed come. This is who God vindicates, people who have chosen the road of cruciformity. So, I mean, that's what we live with hope. We're people of hope.
Yes.
Which is not easy at all, but I mean, this is why we need the body of Christ to hold us to this resurrection truth.
Yeah.
We've almost not learned to surrender to his presence in the midst of any type of conflict or any type of challenge. One of my mentors always tells me, when things get heated in the room, ask yourself the question, how would an emotionally secure person respond to this? and pretend like you're emotionally secure in the moment. So in that moment, just we've lost. It's almost like our culture numbs us to self. It's almost as if we're not aware of what's going on inside of us, and so because we're unaware of what's happening inside of us, we're unable to respond with grace and with mercy and with security. So what are some practices, Rich, that help us get to a place where we are self-aware in that moment of conversation, in that moment of leadership where something hinges on what we're doing? How do we become more self-aware rather than trying to co-opt something within someone else?
Yeah, great question. And I have the answer.
Oh, listen up, hit record.
Yep, yeah.
I have an answer. And I'll tell you why. I have an answer because I have struggled this for many years, and I really experienced a breakthrough last October, November, a personal breakthrough that freed me from the shackles of all this inner turmoil that I was experiencing that on the outside no one would know. And what I began doing, so just a quick background, in August of last, I've been studying family systems theory for a long, over a decade. And part of that is because I'm part of New Life Fellowship Church. Pete did his doctorate in family systems theory, focusing on genogram. And so, I mean, I've been discipled by this guy for a long time. And so I started reading this stuff for many years. But last year, I started diving deeper into it and reading some of the original source material, the Murray Bowen, the Ed Friedman, the Peter Steinke, the Ronald Richardson, these folks here who are giving good language, who have given good language to it. And so I started reading it and focusing on differentiation, trauma, genograms and such. And at one point, what I began to do was take a ruthless inventory of my reactions. And there was just a season where I found myself triggered a lot. And it's not triggered by everyone, but there's particular people that trigger me. Someone could, I mean, I greet people in the lobby every Sunday after services, and not everyone is happy with what I said, but everyone who has a critical remark doesn't trigger me the same. It's just like, oh, thanks for sharing, whatever. But then another person shares and I'm just like thinking about it for 2 days.
Yes.
And so I started doing inventory on my reactions. I don't know how I came to that. That moment of like, hey, I need to just, but for maybe there was a 3 week period in November where every moment where I felt an anxiety rising up, whether it came from my spouse, whether it came from the board chair, whether it came from Pete, whether it came from a long-term, long-standing congregant, whether it came from a person, a nationally known figure who said a word of not even criticism, but some feedback. I started taking down my reactions to these scenarios. And what I was doing with the reactions, I would, what happened? What was my reaction? What's the story I'm telling myself? What's the gospel have to say to this? This was like, I was doing a lot of work, man. And I was doing maybe two or three of these a day. I mean, that's how triggered I was getting with emails. And then I'm on social media. I'll say something on social media. And I have a lot to say on social media. And I say a lot. I mean, it was said about Thomas Merton. He didn't have any like undocumented thought. You know, everything he thought was documented on some paper. And I feel the same awesome about my life with just Twitter and all that. But because I go out and say things, I'm going to get pushback. So I, for 3 weeks straight, I had a file just on my phone here. And I would prayerfully reflect on those things. What happened? What was my reaction? What's the story I'm telling myself? What's the gospel say? Almost in those layers there. And I found that in 3 weeks of doing this, I started to, I was almost looking objectively at myself as if I was looking at another person and going, if I were to pastor that person, what would I say?
It's good.
And I started, first of all, I started getting really generous and gentle with myself.
Oh, wow.
As I was going through just, it was really a compassionate curiosity. It wasn't like this obsessive. I was really being compassionately curious with my interior life. And all I know is I did this for 3 weeks. And at one point, I just felt a break. Like, I'm not as bothered or triggered. Not that I'm like a fully non-anxious presence. I don't think anyone ever lives up to that reality. But I just found myself not being as triggered and carrying things internally as much as I did. I can't explain. The only way I could explain it is this. I preached on Jesus turning water into wine. And before he does the miracle, he tells the servants to fill each jar to the brim. He has them do a lot of work. With, they didn't have like a hose in the backyard. He had them just do all that work.
Yeah.
And after they did all that work to the brim, a miracle happened. And I thought, I have to do a lot of work here. And at some moment, Jesus is going to surprise me. And when he surprises me, I can't take any credit for either, even though I've done the work. And so to Dallas Willard's point, you know, grace is not opposed to effort. It's opposed to earning. Mm-hmm. But I had to do the work. So that's one way for me, paying attention to my reactions as a simple practice with regularity and discipline. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I've led other people along these lines as well, folks in my church. And they have experienced some freedom as well. But I think it gives you an opportunity to look outside yourself and go, man, I'm really caught up in a lot of these internal scripts, messages, antagonisms that are just destroying me. I need to be free.
It's good. Something I think shifts in our leadership when we start recognizing our own opportunities to be transformed in the midst of our leadership. It's almost like pastoring is our remedial discipleship program, right? So this is every day I get these opportunities for me to grow in the Spirit and to learn to follow him and learn to surrender and learn to lay down myself. And this is the program that I go through in order for this to happen. And something redemptive happens in that space.
That's really good.
My responsibility is to position myself to be transformed by Jesus. I can't transform anybody else. And ironically, if I now make my own transformation the priority of my life, I think that what begins to happen is that that's a bit contagious and that starts spreading. Yep. Now I'm preaching differently. I'm leading differently. I'm counseling differently out of a free true self, as opposed to this false self, performance oriented self that has to be contrived and created. I think paradoxically people are more free because I'm free now.
Yes they are.
Freer.
Yes. Yep.
Yes.
Yeah. So true. I mean, Rich, you're speaking our language here. I mean, this is basically what we train leaders to do in our cohorts.
Rich, your process you went through is exactly what we do with people in our cohorts.
Yeah.
And we train them to do it.
Yeah. Instead of getting caught inside of the thing, you start to see, like, what's my reaction? Like, what's the story I'm telling myself?
Because it's what we do, Rich. Yeah. I think you're brilliant.
Your answer to the question was great. Yes.
No, it's my experience too. I just want to say, like, even using some of the same language we're using, and it's deeply encouraging. Mm-hmm. I really feel like there's this beautiful thing in the kingdom that transcends normal boundary lines between different kinds of Christians or different theological streams, where there's this work of letting the cross start in the pit of your stomach, in the midst of your guts, and letting it work its way out from there. Like, we see this all the time and on this podcast and the coaching we do and your own personal story, Rich. And it's deeply, deeply encouraging because it's the hope to transform the world.
Yes.
You know, this resurrection life that gets from the ground up, from our bones up, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
It's the heart of contemplation. Well, you know, you talked about
so
contemplation
much training,
earlier.
So much of our training on here's the five ways to get here. Here's the three ways to develop this. So it's this technical, tactical style of leadership training rather than this adaptive self-awareness. So the work that you're doing, Rich, is so, so valuable and so important. So I just want to affirm and just continue to say, keep going, man. Keep writing, keep speaking, keep sharing those thoughts unfiltered. we need it.
And I would say, I mean, I don't know how many pastors are thinking about this, but next year, an election year, I think I, around the world and around the church, in particular in the United States, in a post 2016 world, we better be doing this work. Yes. And I don't know of how many pastors are actually doing this, but it's probably going to get even more divisive and tense in the coming year. And if pastors are not leading the way to be non-anxious presence, holding on to themselves while, or staying close to themselves while staying close to others in times of high anxiety, we have no chance to work for any kind of transformation in our community. Right. So
that's a good word.
Yeah.
Good word.
So Rich says, make contemplation great again. And we and we affirm it, Rich. We affirm it. Thanks for coming on, man. Thanks for sharing this with us. Where can we, if we're listening and we want to connect more with you, how would we do that?
You can go on Twitter, just Rich Velotis, at Rich Velotis. As a heads up, I'm not sure when this is being released here, but I'm going on sabbatical starting Monday. And I'll be off of social media for 3 months, so pray for me go away. I told my wife that if any breaking news happens, like with the Knicks, whatever like that, that I will jump on her Facebook and Twitter.
Just can't be my own. Yeah.
I'll text
Durant's coming any day now.
I'll text you if KD comes the Knicks.
I pray. So there on Instagram as well, same Rich Velotis, newlife.nyc. That's where you know, see sermons and such. And I would say, I mean, I announced this last week, but some of the things I'm talking about, I just signed the contract to with Waterbrook to write a book called The Deeply Formed Life, in which I'm holding together the five streams or root pillars, really, of our church, of the monastic tradition, race, interiority, what we just talked about, sexuality and justice as a means of a paradigm for following Jesus in this world. So I'm going to be unpacking a lot of that, and hopefully that'll come out in the fall of 2020. But
awesome, man.
Great.
I've been working on that for a while.
Great. Good. Well, if we don't have you on before, then we'll have you on to talk about that. That sounds like an awesome project.
That'd be sweet.
Enjoy your sabbatical, brother.
Thanks, fellas.
Yep. Peace.
Peace.
Blessings.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Leadership Podcast. If you enjoy learning from this podcast, please be sure to show your support by rating, reviewing, and subscribing on iTunes. Be sure to share with your friends on social media too. And we would love to hear from you, so please email us at podcast@gravityleadership.com. You can join our online community for free at gravityleadership.com/join. You'll get our latest content delivered straight to your inbox, as well as an email most Fridays with curated links to articles we found interesting or helpful. To join us, go to gravityleadership.com/join.